Brookings Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. For many Americans, the Islamic State was first burned in our minds as a threat back in August 2014. That's when the terror group released chilling video of American journalist James Foley being beheaded by a black-clad man who condemns U.S. airstrikes in Iraq. Foley, of course, was much more than a victim of terror or a martyr for the free flow of information. He was also a son, a brother, a colleague, and a friend. On today's edition of Global Journalist, we're going to talk more about the life of James Foley. We'll also look at what his death tells us not only about him, but about how news organizations operate overseas and how the U.S. government handles hostage situations. The story of Foley's life and death is told in a new movie from HBO documentary film called Jim, The James Foley Story. It was an audience award winner at this year's Sundance Film Festival and screened at the True False Festival in Missouri in early March. Joining us to talk about Foley's career and captivity is Brian Oakes. He's the director of Jim, The James Foley Story. Brian, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And before we get going, we have a clip we want to show our audience in just a moment. Tell us, how did you get interested in doing a documentary about James Foley?
Well, Jim was actually a close childhood friend of mine. We grew up in a small town in New Hampshire called Wolfboro. Very idyllic upbringing. I'd known Jim for his entire life. We've been, and I've known the Foley family. And so my interest was strictly because he was a friend. And, after Jim was killed, the world witnessed, his death very publicly. And I felt like I had a responsibility to tell Jim's story. I thought the image that everyone knew of James Foley was being used in ways that I felt uncomfortable with, whether it was propagated for political advantages or it wasn't the way that I wanted Jim's legacy and the image of Jim to go down in history. So I wanted to be the person to tell his story and, in essence, try to reclaim that image of him, that the way everyone knew him.
That closeness that you speak of with his family is certainly an evidence in the documentary. We're going to look at a clip right now of Jim's brother Michael talking about the day that he learned that Jim had died.
I was in my office at work, and I got a call from an international number. I always through the last 3 years, when I was in an international call, I'd answer it. And it was a reporter in Dublin, wanted a reaction story. I said, reaction for what? And they really caught back by that question, obviously. They said, I'll call you back in 5 minutes. And so then I went online and saw the picture. It's not the way you want to find out. I never, ever imagined that it would end in that fashion, right?
Brian, tell us just a little bit about how your approach in talking to family members about this. Obviously, a really public, really difficult death for them.
Yeah. The Foley family had been approached by a number of people that were interested in Jim's story and telling his story. And because I knew Jim and I knew the Foley family, there was I've known them my whole life. So there was skeptical and a little hesitant at first for the family to take on be a part of this project. It was a difficult decision for them. Completely understood. It was a difficult choice for me to even take this on. But because there was a comfort factor that the Foley family and I have, I expressed what my goals were for the film and what I wanted to do for Jim, they trusted me and they gave me that, or allowed me to take on that responsibility, and so it was obviously difficult and a lot of emotional moments during our interviews, but ultimately, we were I was happy with the way that I was able to portray and tell the story.
Well, what about you? Where were you? How did you find out about Jim's death?
Kind of like however we all found out. I was just going about our normal day routine. I was actually in the park in Brooklyn. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. And I got a text saying, saying that just so sorry to hear about Jim. And at that point I knew, I mean, Jim had been missing for about 2 years since, you know, when he was killed. And so I kind of, you know, immediately knew that something bad had happened. And of course, it didn't take long to find out.
Well, you knew Jim growing up. Can you tell us just a little bit about his personality and sort of his trajectory before he became a journalist?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, we went to a small high school in New Hampshire, and Jim went to Marquette University. I went to Syracuse University. And so we were kind of, you know, amongst another group, others in our school, we wanted to kind of get out of small town New England and go to kind of bigger places. So we definitely had kind of a drive to see the world. And so Jim went to Marquette and where he studied history and Spanish. And then after Marquette, he joined Teach for America and was a teacher in Phoenix, Arizona for about 3 years. And, you know, really, really wanted to, you know, Jim was always about kind of the working with and helping the underprivileged and the people who, you know, he felt needed a voice, you know, and so he kind of worked in the inner city schools in Phoenix. And then after that, he went to Chicago and taught in the prison systems to, you know, inmates who were making the transition from prison out back into society. He taught English and in a Cook County boot camp. And I think he was always a writer as well. He was writing a novel, and he wrote fiction. And I think before he decided to go to UMass for creative writing, and ultimately Medill for journalism school, he really kind of decided, like, you know, why am I writing fiction about all these stories that I want to tell? It's like there are all people out there that need these stories, so I'm gonna choose to do that. And that's how he kind of decided to go into journalism. And after he graduated from Medill, his first embed was with the Indiana National Guard in Afghanistan, and that kind of set him on his course of conflict journalism from there.
We'll hear more about the career of James Foley in just a moment. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about the life and death of James Foley, the American journalist captured by ISIS and then executed in 2014. We're joined by Brian Oakes, the director of a new film about Foley's life called Jim, The James Foley Story. It screened at this year's Sundance Film Festival and the True False Film Festival in Missouri. Brian Oakes, you mentioned that James Foley, he did travel to Afghanistan with the Indian National Guard, and then he went to Libya in 2011 during the revolution that would eventually topple Muammar Gaddafi. Tell us just a little bit about his experiences there.
Yeah, I mean, he started covering the Libyan revolution in 2011. I think Jim, he really was interested in the stories of the revolutionaries, the citizens of Libya who were feeling oppressed and you know wanted to overthrow the Gaddafi regime. And you know, when he went into Libya, there wasn't, you know, leaving the security of the you know US military, being a journalist embedded with the US military group, and going into a revolution where now you're embedded with Libyan revolutionaries. It was a big transition for him because now you kind of leave the safety of that situation, and now you're kind of befriending Libyans and counting on them to drive you around. And you know, when you go into these situations, you need to make sure you have a fixer who can translate and show you where to go and to drive you places. And of course, other colleagues that Jim was with, they would kind of work together and help support as well.
And the work it appears incredibly dangerous, actually. And in the film, one of Jim's colleagues is discussing how there had been sort of more experienced photojournalists operating in some of the areas in eastern Libya where they were during the revolution, decided it was too dangerous and decided to leave. And we have a clip from one of Jim's colleagues talking about sort of what drew them to doing such incredibly dangerous work. We're going to have a look at that right now.
I think that matters. What I'm doing matters. You have to be really stupid or you risk your life for $300 a day. That's the point. I'm not doing that for the $300. At the very end, I will need to face my life at some point, and I just want to be proud.
It's Jim's colleague, a Spanish photographer named Manu, talking about, it sounds like he's doing this work because he wants to be part of something bigger. Is that something that you saw in Jim as well?
I think so. Ultimately, it's the thesis of the film. It's a question that I asked myself, a lot of people asked after Jim had been killed, is why was Jim over there? Why is he putting himself in danger to cover these stories? And I think, sometimes in an accusatory way. And so ultimately, that was a question that I wanted the film to answer. And through Manu, the other journalists in the film are Claire Gillis and Nicole Tung and Zach Bailey, all colleagues of Jim who worked with him. They're kind of my surrogates for Jim. And they all have their own reasons for why they do what they do. All very important. And I think answering that question of why these conflict journalists are over there risking their lives to bring us these stories is a really important part of the film and what I wanted to capture.
And ultimately, we have Jim talking about that in his own words. I believe we have a clip of him speaking at Marquette University that you use in the film as well, talking about sort of why he felt it was important to be doing this kind of work.
I believe that frontline journalism is important. Without these photos and videos and first-hand experience, we can't really tell the world how bad it might be.
And ultimately, in Libya, James and his colleagues did come under attack. They got basically too close to Gaddafi's forces, and one of Jim's colleagues was killed, one of the people he was traveling with. He was captured along with some of the other photographers and reporters that he was traveling with. Tell us about that. Tell us about his captivity in Libya.
Yeah, so one morning, Jim and Manu and Claire Gillis and Anton Hamerl, they decided that they were going to go out to the front lines with some of the Libyan rebels. And they ultimately came under fire by the Gaddafi regime. Anton lost his life, and Jim, Manu, and Claire were detained and taken into the Gaddafi prison system, where they spent about 44 days. And Jim, after that experience, was definitely a changed man. I mean, he felt a lot of guilt about what had happened, and I think was questioning his motives about what he was doing and how he would go about doing the work on the front lines. And I think that experience really changed him as a journalist. And after that, when he after Libya, he went to Syria, but I think that experience really made him think about what he was doing and how he would go about it.
And so what do we know about his decision-making process then, after having seen one of his colleagues be killed almost right next to him in this attack, being held by Gaddafi's forces for 44 days? he comes home for several months, and then he decides to go to Libya. So Syria. What was that decision-making process for him? Because I believe in the film, initially he says, I went too far, words to that effect, like, I shouldn't do something like this anymore.
You know, ultimately, you know, I have my own opinions, and I think, you know, Jim's friends have theirs. You know, I think ultimately, we never will really know why that decision to go back to Syria. I can only kind of guess, or, you know, this documentary is kind of trying to answer that question. But I think, you know, one of the, and it's a very layered answer. It's not a very black and white situation. And Jim, you know, he talks about this siren song. It's about context and trying to imagine yourself in this situation. So when you're in a war zone and what you're seeing, when you're seeing children being killed, when you're running around and bombs are going off, and you're just seeing a world that is completely different than anything you've ever seen. When you leave that and you come back to the safety of your home or the United States, it's a very difficult feeling, adjustment to make for them. And it kind of, that world of the war zone kind of becomes more of a reality. And so there's this draw that they feel. You know, we talk about soldiers, you know, having post-traumatic stress. It's kind of a similar situation. And I think when Jim left, he was drawn back to the situation because that kind of became the world that he felt like these are the stories that need to be told. And if I'm not going to do it, I don't know who else is going to. And so but he's also being pulled by this, you know, the family and friends who were not wanting to go back, but at the same time, we wanted to support what he was doing. So it's complicated. And I think a lot of journalists have a similar kind of feeling, like this is their job. This is what they want to be doing. These stories are important. I mean, this is history. And these are stories that the world needs to know so we as a civilization can understand the things going on. And he knew that, and he felt that, and it was really important to him.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about the life and death of James Foley, the American journalist captured by ISIS and then executed in 2014. We're joined by Brian Oakes, the director of a new film about Foley's life called Jim, The James Foley Story. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @GlobalJourn. So ultimately, Brian Oakes, Jim does go back to Syria, and we're going to hear a clip now about from his sister speaking about when hearing the news that he was captured and her reaction to that.
You know, 5 o'clock rolls by, and I started to worry. 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock rolls around, and I'm like, something is really wrong. So I called Mustafa, and the first thing he said to me was, Nicole, I'm so sorry. I couldn't do anything. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, what happened? He was like, you know, we were coming. We were in the taxi. We were coming to Turkey to meet you. And this van with these four guys with guns, they stopped us on the road. And they told us to get out. And they were pointing their guns at us and screaming. And the gunmen made Mustafa tie up their hands. And they put John and Jim into the back of their van. So I hung up and I just started crying. I was like, I didn't know if I was going to see Jim again. And that was the first thought that came to my head.
So, yeah, that was Nicole Tong, actually, who was a photojournalist and a very close colleague of Jim in Syria. You know, Jim was on his way out of Syria, headed to Turkey to meet Nicole, who you just heard from. He was captured, kidnapped. And at that point, you know, there's kind of a lot to talk about. You know, on the one hand, this is a very different experience than what we experienced in Libya. When Jim was captured in Libya, we knew who had him. It was a government, you know, the Gaddafi regime, you know, it's still a government. So there was an opportunity to discuss and kind of follow. We knew he was alive. This was a completely different situation. We're in a, you know, at the time, there, you know, we know now, I mean, this is also very important to know, when Jim was kidnapped in Syria, ISIS didn't even exist, at least in our knowledge. This is a year before, even more before they kind of came out. So the temperature, the climate in Syria at that time, there were kind of jihadist groups forming. A lot of foreign fighters were coming into the country, and radicalization was starting to percolate to the surface. So when Jim was captured, it was a very complicated situation because there were a lot of moving parts in Syria at the time. So we didn't know who took him. We didn't know if it was the Assad regime, what jihadist group it might have been. And so that made it a much more difficult and dangerous situation for us. Us meaning the, you know, family and friends. And actually, when Jim first was taken, the Foley family weren't told not to say anything. So it wasn't after probably about 2 months, a month, that we were able to kind of know about it.
And you were able to interview a number of people that were held captive with Jim while he was in Syria. Tell us just a little bit about what we know about his captivity from them.
Sure. So it's also important to know that when Jim was captured, he was captured with another journalist that he was with. And it was about a year before he was put into a prison with other journalists and other captured aid workers, journalists from mostly European. It was Spanish, French, Danish, Italian, German, English. So this is about, you know, for that first year, Jim, we don't know too much about where he was. Only until he was put in with all these other men, where this kind of stories happen. And so, you know, his experience, of course, was a very surreal captivity. That's you know, I learned a lot of what was happening, and that was the second part of the film, is all about his captivity and my discovery of what was happening. You know, and I think what I found was what was really kind of important to me was kind of finding out about the society and the group and how these 19 men created a world that they could survive in. And that was a lot of the focus of the film, because, you know, there are torture details and information that has been out there, that, you know, written by, you know, media. But my interest did not lie there. My interest was more of what was happening with Jim and how was he interacting with people and what was that experience.
And ultimately, a number of those people who were held with Jim were released, mainly those from European countries. Tell us just a little bit about that. Why were some of the Europeans released? Jim, an American, was not.
Sure. So essentially, at that time, the American government and the British government, their hostage policy is that they do not negotiate with terrorists. European countries such as Spain and France, Italy, they negotiate and ultimately will pay a ransom to get their citizens released, and that was pretty cut and dry. So there was no negotiation for the Americans that were held or the British. And so that ultimately became, a very important part of Jim's story.
And I want to ask you as well about the role of Global Post, which was the news outlet that Jim worked for primarily. What was their involvement? What is their responsibility to him as a journalist, as his sort of part-time freelance employer, if you will, given that he's taking such enormous risks for not really a huge amount of money?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to understand that the culture of journalists over the past, 5 years or so, there's a lot of freelancers. It's changed since, foreign bureaus are not, they're relying on freelance journalists to go into these areas and bring them stories and photographs and video. And Jim was a freelance journalist, as was Nicole and Claire and Manu. And so Global Post was the online news organization that Jim was working for. And, when Jim went missing, both in Libya and in Syria, Global Post, as far as when Syria happened, they hired a security team because the government was not going to get involved. So America has to rely, if you're an American, you have to rely on a private security team to go and try to find someone. So Global Post was a part of that, finding that team and doing that.
Well, we do have just about 30 seconds left, but I wanted to ask you as well, you don't play the video of Jim's death in the film, and I wanted to ask you about that decision because it's obviously the fact that his death was filmed is part of the reason why he became, his death is so famous. Why did you decide to not use that? I mean, have you watched this film yourself?
I have not watched the film. There's an edited version, an unedited version, but really it's a very simple choice. It's not what the film is about. This film is not about Jim's death. It's about his life. And I also, this is a big question. It's too bad we only have 30 seconds because, we as consumers of media now are in an age where we can choose what we want to watch. And there is, everything is out there. And, I didn't want people to have the anxiety, an audience, to someone who would want to watch the story of Jim. I didn't want to make them anxious about something that they might or may or may not see. So I felt it was important to have that disclaimer up front that wasn't part of my choice to show that. And I think it's also, it's not my decision to take someone's choice away from watching something like that was not something that I wanted to do. So those were kind of the reasons that I made that decision.
Brian Oakes, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That'll do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Global Journalist executive producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our lead producer this week is Javilla Ruskaskate. Our studio director is Travis McMillan of RJI. Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us.